Hello. 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 We shall go on to the end. We shall fight for scientific heresy in France. We shall fight for it on Twitter and YouTube. We shall fight for it with ever-growing confidence and strength in the air. We shall defend scientific heresy, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And if you are asking yourself why I am dressed in this thoroughly Churchillian manner today, it is because it is my intention to discuss the great man himself, Winston Churchill, Britain's national hero, and to emphasize to you that he was not Britain's national hero at all. So, let's stop talking in this thoroughly Churchillian manner, take off some of this extremely Churchillian garb perhaps later, and get on with it. Winston Churchill is commonly understood to be Britain's national hero. He is the people's aristocrat with a tipple in one hand, with a cigar, you know, in the other. He's the man who won the war. He's the man that fought off the evil Nazi menace. And my view somewhat differs from that, and it relates strongly, in fact, to a lot of the scientific research I've done. The idea there is essentially a kind of Winston Churchill cult in the UK, and to a lesser extent in many other countries, in which it basically the argument is that Winston Churchill is a genius, military genius. Winston Churchill is an absolute hero. Winston Churchill is a kind of godlike figure, and as a consequence of this, anything that is anathemized by the church, anything by the Church of Churchill, anything which is considered a bad thing, is thoroughly evil. Now, a good example of this is Churchill's prep school headmaster. Prep school is the school, if you're a member of the upper class or upper middle class, and you're very rich, it's a kind of private school that you go to between the ages of about 8 and about 13, 12, 13, something like that, before you go on to public school. That's schools like Eton and Harrow, which is where Churchill went, these kinds of places. And his prep school headmaster, Herbert Snaid Kinnersley, who was the headmaster of Churchill's school, St. George's Ascot, has gone down in history as through things that Churchill has written and through things that his relatives have written as being a perverted sadist, as being a person who would beat children with a birch on their bare buttocks until explosions of their excreta were to be found all over the walls of his study. And he would then take sexual pleasure in cleaning these explosions of excreta off the walls. He was a pervert, he was a sadist, he was a deeply sick man. In his book, this person, Herbert Snaid Kinnersley, a headmaster of St. George's Ascot, in Churchill's book, My Early Life, he argues that the beatings that people received, it should be stressed that the beating was the common system at these public schools and these prep schools. All children were beaten on their bare buttocks with a birch or with a cane for serious offences. Now, Churchill was known to be extremely badly behaved, but even so, he says that the beatings that were carried out at this school were worse than anything that was carried out at Eton or was carried out at reform schools under the Home Office. That is to say, schools where children who were particularly bad, you know, particularly criminal, were placed as a punishment. Roger, another person that's helped to promote this idea of Herbert Snaid Kinnersley as just being an evil, vile sadist is Roger Fry. Roger Fry was a very left-wing art critic and artist in the 1920s and 1930s. He associated with people like Virginia Woolf and E.M. Forster. E.M. Forster, by the way, the writer of Passage to India, argued that if he had to choose between betraying his country and betraying his friend, he'd hope he'd have the courage to betray his friend. So these are very left-wing group of people. And Fry went to St. George's Ascot, and Fry noted that the severity with which Snaid Kinnersley beat children
children. He said that they beat them. He beat them with a birch until they bled. He said they would scream in pain and so forth. He said that in one instance, he beat a child till he excreted with pain and with fear and with diarrhea or whatever. And then meticulously carried on and then cleaned the excreta off the walls. So that's the single source of that allegation. Fry said that Snake Kinnersley was uneducated. He implied Snake Kinnersley was stupid. He implied Snake Kinnersley was childlike, and that there was really very little good about him as a teacher. He didn't inspire much in Roger Fry. So it is these two sources that have been developed into the truth about Herbert Snake Kinnersley, about Churchill's headmaster, about this idea that he's basically just a sick, stupid, uneducated, also that he was a bigoted high church Tory, a humourless pervert. And this is how he is presented in the 1970 film Young Winston as well. He's entirely presented following these two sources, which were presented in Randolph Churchill, Churchill's son's biography of his father. Now, I got thinking about this because of various things I found out about Churchill, which tend to be suppressed by the Churchill cult, various very interesting pieces of information. Not least that Churchill, far from being this perfect human being, this godlike figure, was a narcissist, who was considered to be a narcissist in the 1920s when he was out of office. People just thought he had no principle, people had no time for him, people thought his career had run its course, and he was just no good. He was a useless war leader in World War I who took the country into Gallipoli, which was a disastrous campaign in which thousands of young men were completely unnecessarily killed. While he was Chancellor, he messed up the economy, basically, and as a consequence, the Depression lasted much longer than it could have done. He was incredibly reckless, even when he was a young boy, for example. He was playing some kind of game of chase. He jumped over a wall and ended up being unconscious for days because he smashed his head on the ground. He took quite extraordinary risks. When he finished at a military academy, he made a point of getting himself sent to war zones because he basically just liked war, and he liked the thrill of war, and he just liked all this bloodshed and so on. So he was basically a kind of psychopath, who enjoyed being in the thick of violence. During World War I, he resigned his position, he was put out of office, and so he went off and joined the army just to be at the front because he just enjoyed the experience of all this kind of thing. He was unquestionably an alcoholic, and there is evidence that during World War II, he would be completely pissed at meetings with senior American diplomats or with members of his own party or with members of the government, and even Mackenzie King, who was the Canadian Prime Minister, commented that he was at this meeting and he'd heard that Churchill was just pissed out of his mind and was in no state to do anything. And this is during the height of a very serious war. He was absolutely pissed. Clearly, he was very overweight, so this implies to you low impulse control, aspects of sort of psychopathic personality. He was completely financially shambolic and had this strong sense of entitlement and so on. So, for example, once he was out of office in the early 1930s, he had absolutely no money because the salaries for cabinet MPs at that time were very low, and so he used various nefarious means in order to try and get money and maintain his massive stately home, Chartwell in Kent, including being paid by a group called the Focus, who wanted to ensure that there was a war against Germany, and therefore, in order to get money from them, he did all that he could relentlessly to prosecute the case for a war against Germany, which most people at that time didn't want, and because they remembered the horror of World War I and how they'd all lost children and all this kind of thing. And so he did all that he could to prosecute the case for a second war, and he successfully did so. He was a chronic gambler and lost huge amounts of money as a chronic gambler. And during the war itself, there were numerous opportunities to make peace. Hitler wanted to make peace. Hitler tried to make peace. At the evacuation of Dunkirk, Hitler could have destroyed the fleeing British army, but he didn't, seemingly because he wanted to give them the chance of an honourable suing for peace. Then, by 1941, Churchill just wouldn't hear of any kind of peace. And so, of course, Hitler sent famously Rudolf Hess, or to go to Scotland with his to find his contact, the Duke of Hamilton, and to try to negotiate some kind of peace. And Churchill would not have it. Churchill wanted a war. He wanted absolute out-and-out war. There were lots and lots of people in his cabinet that were doves compared to him and didn't want to go too far. But Churchill was absolutely adamant that there should be a war, and that when a few stray German bombs fell on Rotherhithe, Churchill used that as a means to persuade people that the Germans were bombing civilians and therefore there should be full-on war. So he was a warmonger. He was, in a lot of that, there were good things about him, of course. He was charismatic. In that sense, he was the person you want at times of crisis, the person you want at times of fear, the person who could make a cold world feel warm again. He was the essence of the charismatic. And charismatic, he was a manic depressive as well. And charismatics often are these damaged people who, because they've suffered, they can alleviate suffering in other people through their charisma. But he obviously had no concern for the lives of other people. This was evidenced in the evacuation of Singapore, in the fight against Singapore, against the Japanese. He made it quite clear they should fight till the last man, no surrender. It would be a humiliation to lose Singapore. So in many respects, this rosy-tinted view of Winston Churchill is not an accurate one. He was, as far as I can see, a highly intelligent narcissist. He was a very bad man. And this got me then thinking, well, if that aspect of the Churchill cult is open to question, if Churchill is not actually this wonderful hero, you know, cigar in one hand and V for victory in the other, then perhaps there are other things we should question. And one of the things that anyone knows anything about Churchill knows is that his headmaster was this perverted sadist. So this got me questioning this. And there are so many Churchill biographies, and all of them don't really cite any primary sources or really anything. They just go back to other biographies in this big circle of Churchill loving. And then things get exaggerated over time, and you get to the insane point where there was a biography of Churchill or Churchill's family where a woman called Anna Seber argued that the headmaster, Sir Herbert Snaith Kinnersley of St George's Ascot, was this sadist who would beat children until explosions of excreta dotted his walls, and then he'd take pleasure in cleaning it off. It's total exaggeration of the most extraordinary kind. And so I thought, well, let's look into this. Maybe it's not true. Maybe Snaith Kinnersley has been maligned by history. Let's look into this. And so I did, for the first time. No one's ever done this before. No one's ever done a biography of Herbert Snaith Kinnersley. And I found, first of all, that the two sources that were negative about him were Churchill and Fry. Those are deeply problematic sources. Firstly, Churchill said that, according to Fry, the standard number of Snaith Kinnersley strokes with the Burkes was between 15 and 20. Now, and Churchill said, oh, well, it outdid anything at reform schools. Well, Churchill was Home Secretary. Churchill would have known what was going on at reform schools. And I looked into this, and 15 or 20 strokes of the birch for a miscreant child at a reform school was perfectly normative while he was Home Secretary. So that's a complete lie. He's simply exaggerating what the headmaster, what Snaith Kinnersley was like, in order to make him look bad. That's a lie. Secondly, it should be noted that Churchill was extremely poorly behaved. And he writes about being, that was what happened. That was the standard punishment for people that were very poorly behaved. They would be beaten. Thirdly, there was a source by the name of Claude Schuster, who was the secretary to the Lord Chancellor's office, who was at school with Churchill. And he recalled that Churchill was abominably behaved beyond anything he could even comprehend. That everybody hated him because he was so badly behaved. That the headmaster, all he recalled about the headmaster was that he gave out the most sumptuous and amazing prizes if you were good. If you were good, you got these incredibly expensive and wonderful prizes and so on, and treats. And he remembered that there was one occasion where Churchill got up on a table and started singing a very rude stable song. And Snaith Kinnersley told him, if you don't stop, I will birch you. He didn't birch him. He said, if you don't stop, I will birch you. So this is showing you that you had to be pretty bad in order to receive the birch. Because he didn't even get it on this occasion. And Churchill, in a time where swearing and so on was considered to be absolutely appalling. Churchill also states how miserable he was and how awful it was there. And this doesn't seem to be the case if you look into it. If you look into the original letters home, it seems quite happy. He's writing about all the Mrs. Kinnersley, the headmaster's wife, buying him a nice birthday present and all the nice fun things they've done and all this kind of thing. And only later does it start to become this awful, when he's writing about it in 1930, not at the time, i.e. a much less reliable source than something contemporary, does it start to become absolutely appalling. Apparently, there's another thing that's developed about Churchill, which is that Snake Kiddersley beat him so badly that his wounds became infected, and that he had to be removed from that school to, became ill, removed from that school to a different school, a school in Brighton. Again, this isn't true. If you look into the actual sources of this information, the idea that the from the film that the nanny saw that he'd been beaten and told his mother about it, and then he was removed. This is incredibly unlikely. First of all, we know that the nannies would regularly undress their charges, even up to the age of being teenagers, and consequently would see them naked. So if he was being beaten at any point heavily during his time at school, then she would have noticed this. Secondly, there is evidence nannies would obviously spank their charges, and that it would be on the bare bottom, and so therefore she would see his buttocks at numerous points during the holidays from St George's Ascot, this boarding school. So that, again, that becomes unlikely. Thirdly, it's asserted that he was taken away from the school because of this. Well, he was taken away from the school in the summer of 1884, and by this time he was getting good school reports by his standards, which would imply that he wasn't being beaten at all. He was getting good school, positive school reports. So this is likely to be complete nonsense. That it's and contemporary sources state that he was taken away from the school simply because he had pneumonia and chest problems and things as a consequence of being born prematurely, and that's why he was taken to a school in Brighton, where the family also had their own physician. So this seems to be absolute rubbish, this idea that he was taken away from the school solely because of Snake Kinnersley's vicious and sadistic beatings. It's just not true. Apparently he said to his second cousin once removed, when he was a very elderly man, in the 50s, that, the school tried to break me down, and if my nanny hadn't noticed this, I would have been broken down. But he was saying this when he was in his 80s, by which time, after he resigned as Prime Minister, by which time it was understood that he was completely senile, so he was unlikely to have any reliable memory of anything. So all of these stories about Churchill simply don't make sense. He exaggerates things. He is a person in 1930 who exaggerates things to make a good and interesting story. One of the things he states in his memoirs is that he was arrested when he was in South Africa by General Botha. And that General Botha recognised him years later in London and said, "You don't remember me, I arrested you when we were in South Africa." It's just not true. General Botha did not arrest him. This is a fact. It's simply not true. So this is a person who he's a narcissist. He wants to come across as in the best possible light. He wants to come across as dramatic and fantastic and interesting and so on. And so he lies. He exaggerates. He's not a good source of information about even himself. And it seems that a lot of the things that he said about Snake Kinnersley are exaggerated. Moreover, he is a depressive, and it's well known that depressive people, the way that memory works is that people will kind of create potential memories, and if they fit with a narrative that makes you feel good about yourself, then you'll adopt that memory. And this is one of the reasons why memory becomes less and less reliable with age, more and more subject to this editing process of self-aggrandization or whatever it is with age. People who are depressives are particularly likely to remember the world in an unpleasant way and to exaggerate bad things and to play down good things. And it seems quite obvious this is what Churchill was doing with regard to his headmaster. If we then move on to the other source, Roger Fry, this is also true of him. He was also known to be a depressive who would behave in exactly this kind of way, exaggerating things and so on. It seems very likely that the incident about this the boy excreting during being beaten, which he supposedly witnessed because he was head boy and he had to hold boys down while they were being beaten, it's likely that this was an exaggeration, I would think, because we have contemporary letters of his at the time where he seems to, you can read between the lines, it's this beating he's mentioning to his mother, and he's mentioning it in some detail. He's mentioning how the boy screams and how another teacher has to hold him down. A boy called Algernon Ferguson, it was, who was the great-grandfather of Sarah Ferguson, the Duchess of York. And he doesn't mention anything of this. This is something that seems to have come and been exaggerated later. And he's got every reason to dislike Snake Kinnersley, because Snake Kinnersley was extremely right-wing, extremely conservative, extremely traditionalist, extremely religious, this Anglo-Catholic, and in every way the opposite of what the Quaker, liberal, left-wing socialist Roger Fry was. And you'd expect him as this depressive to remember the bad side of things. He was obviously neurotic. He talks about getting an erection after witnessing one beating, which implies neuroticism such that you become sexually aroused by trauma and so on. And so we can probably dismiss much of what he has to say. He also says that Snake Kinnersley is uneducated and stupid, and that he replaces any master that's remotely intelligent with a stupid one. Well, I looked into this, and the masters that he was replacing people with were highly intelligent, highly educated, published lots of books, you know, had doctorates and things like this at a time when hardly anybody had a doctorate. So he's an unreliable source. He's clearly a bad source with an axe to grind. When we look at the more reliable sources, we have the German diplomat Harry Graf, we have Aubrey Jay, who was a barrister, and whose grandson married the daughter of Jim Callaghan. And we have Arthur Bonham Carter, who was a colonial judge, and we have Maurice Baring. They were all at the school and they all left memoirs. And what they show, Graf, that yes, he did beat children, he did beat people, and he did beat people a lot and severely, but he only did so if you were very, very, very bad. And often he'd use other methods, and moreover, he was an incredibly inspiring teacher. Yes, he was probably some sort of unconscious pederast or something like that. But a lot of these male public school teachers are pederasts. That's what motivates these men to get involved with teaching children or whatever, that they're pederasts, and they get some sort of pleasure out of being with children, but they don't actually act on it in a sexual way. He said, well, even probably that was true of Plato, argues Graf, but he was an absolutely inspiring teacher. He made things come to life. He created this wonderful world. It's a wonderful time at school, as long as you behave yourself. He was just the best teacher Graf had ever had. For Arthur Bonham Carter, similarly, he looks at the incredible effort that Snake Kinnersley went into in order to get him into a good public school, to get him into Winchester, and how passionate he was about it, and all this. There's a letter, contemporary letter from the time, that survives. With Aubrey Jay, there's an unpublished memoir in which he looks at this, and he shows this amazing guy. He says, yes, he was probably beat people a bit too severely and in too ritualistic a way. But it should be stressed that all of these schools beat children in this way, beat them with the cane or the birch on the bare buttocks. And they did so often unfairly, indiscriminately, and for very minor things, like ballsing up your Latin prep or whatever. With Snake Kinnersley, it was only for serious offences, for being basically weird or bizarre, or for breaking very, very clear rules. And so he was predictable, and as far as Aubrey Jay was concerned, it was a wonderful time at St George's Ascot. And he was there with Churchill. And he recalls that Churchill was constantly being beaten, because Churchill was just appallingly bad, was just a yob, basically. Poor behaviour was beyond anything. Then there was Maurice Baring. He was a diplomat and a writer, and he gives it's more balanced. But even he shows Snake Kinnersley beating children and this sort of thing, and being quite kind of infantile in his behaviour, arrested development, which would be consistent perhaps with Snake Kinnersley being a pederast or being a sort of a spanking fetishist, as it were, who was perhaps less sexually aroused by, not by hurting people. He obviously wasn't a sadist, because he did so many things to try and make children happy. He had all these amazing school trips. You'd go on to the Isle of Wight and to London to see a play, and to, you know, these incredibly expensive and fun school trips, and he'd do everything, and he would do these amazing stories, and he would just enrapture children. He was this incredible, inspiring teacher. But he had this sort of dark side to him. But even then, it's quite clear that what's been said about him is exaggerated, and he's much less bad than many headmasters who could be mentioned, even perhaps Anthony Shevrick's Trench, who was the headmaster of Eton in the 60s, and he was simply an absolute pervert who would beat 18-year-old sick formers on their bare buttocks and then fondle their bare buttocks before and after the beating and cry while he was drunk doing this and ask them, do you think I'm a pederast? Do you think I'm a pederast? Do you think I'm a pervert? Snake Kinnersley pales into insignificance compared to some of these headmasters that we've got records of, but beating children to death, burning children, God knows what. But he has this terrible press because he was Churchill's headmaster and because he was Roger Fry's headmaster, and that those were particularly Churchill's, and therefore those two people have done all they can to defame him. So as far as I can see, these sources are discredited, and he was a reasonable person. It was his deputy, Robert Escort MacDonald, as I show in my book, it was his deputy who, after Snake Kinnersley died of a heart attack aged 38, became headmaster of St George's Ascot, then merged the school with the school in Winchester, and then had to leave that school and flee the country to Austria because he was found buggering a pupil. And it was his deputy who, when Maurice Baring at his new school, when he left St George's Ascot, went to a school in Eastbourne, it was his deputy, they did a play about St George's Ascot, and they portrayed Robert Escort MacDonald as the evil guy in the play, as the bad one. Not Snake Kinnersley. Snake Kinnersley, he was more ambiguous towards it. It was Escort MacDonald who was regarded as evil, not Snake Kinnersley. So I think Snake Kinnersley needs to, just as Churchill needs to be reassessed, we'd have to reassess Snake Kinnersley. What Snake Kinnersley was a traditionalist. He was a traditionalist in the sense that he understood what it was that caused an empire, what it was that was behind an empire, and what that was essentially a cult. And that cult, as far as he was concerned, was basically the Catholic Church, or the Catholic Church mixed with a bit of Protestantism. He was what you call a high churchman. He was a priest, he was ordained, an Anglo-Catholic, an extreme Anglo-Catholic, what is known as a Tractarian, a person who basically wanted to almost semi-merge the Church of England with the Catholic Church. He was into ritual, he was into tradition, and so on. And as far as he was concerned, the way that you maintain a society, the way that you ensure a society doesn't become decadent, is the maintenance of tradition, the strong maintenance of tradition, and the rejecting of basically anything new, of socialism, of leftism, of these kinds of ways of thinking that essentially demilitarize society and make it less united. That was what he was about. This was expressed in his school, the purpose of which was to educate the children of the upper class, those who would go on to schools like Eton and Winchester and Harrow, as Churchill did, and go on to run the country, to inculcate them with a certain way of seeing the world and with certain values, to inculcate them essentially with the best possible upbringing, that is to say, an upbringing which is harsh yet loving, because this seems to bring about the best possible results according to various pieces of research on this matter. And that's what he did. So they were inculcated with Latin and Greek, because these, of course, were the languages of the great empire that had come before. They were separated from their parents, because this is what Plato recommended, this is what Spartans did, this is what they were kind of imitating. They were imitating the Spartans, and they were brought up in this environment where there were clear boundaries, and where if you crossed those boundaries, it was extremely harsh. But otherwise, you were kind of inspired, and you were made into a gentleman, into where your sense of individualism was to a certain extent sort of crushed down, so that you would to do things for the good of the empire. You would be positively and negatively ethnocentric, and it is these kinds of groups which survive in the battle of group selection. That's what Snake Kinnersley was creating. And it seems to me that had he had more time with Churchill — Churchill was withdrawn from his school after 2 years — he would have succeeded in reducing Churchill's narcissism to more manageable levels, because he was working. I mean, the school reports in 1882 were appalling, and they simply get better and better and better as this supposedly sadistic regime works. They get better and better and better, and by 1884, he's pretty much behaving himself. But unfortunately, due to being ill, due to severe colds and all this kind of thing, he was taken by the sea, and this wasn't able to be finished. And I think that it is relevant that a result of this is you have this narcissistic individual who simply wreaks havoc across Europe and takes us into this unnecessary war. Now this brings us to another, which exhausts the British people, which exhausts the European people, and which directly results in the collapse of the British Empire and in the collapse of and balkanisation of Britain itself into this multicultural problem with lots of conflict and so on that we now have. It seems to me this can be traced back to Churchill, and to a certain extent back to Churchill's removal from this school, which would have de-narcissised him to a very, very great extent by imbuing him with this sense of traditionalism and duty and sort of lower self-esteem and whatever. Now, it could be argued, well, we should have gone to war because what about the Jews? To which it can be countered that the Jews only came into Hitler's orbit because, that much as he hated them, but because of the invasion of Poland. And if he'd simply been given back the parts of Poland which were removed from the Germans at Versailles, we wouldn't have had that problem. Secondly, it can be argued that we were upholding democracy by going into the war, that he invaded Poland, lovely democracy, we should go in and help. No, Poland was a very, very nasty military dictatorship, so that's no argument. Thirdly, it could be argued, oh, well, what if Hitler invaded us? Well, this is most unlikely. As we saw, Hitler was doing everything he could to sue for peace, and he liked the British, and he helped them out at Dunkirk, and he respected them, and saw them as a kin people. So this is very unlikely. Fourthly, it can be argued, well, isn't it our duty to intervene? Shouldn't we be the policemen of the world? Well, that's just an unimaginative view of the British. Why should we be? The Irish kept out of the war. The Swedish kept out of the war. Why shouldn't we keep out of the war? Now, even if you accept, as I've looked at in other books, that the rise and fall of civilizations is inevitable, they always rise and fall, we can still do things to slow down the decline and make the decline more palatable. Well, as far as I can see, Churchill did all that he could to speed it up, and with the war and so on. And it's like he created winter in the midst of autumn, and he would have been less likely to do that if he hadn't been withdrawn from Snake Kinnersley's school. So that's why I think Snake Kinnersley is a much underrated individual. He's an individual that more needs to be known about. He needs to be better understood. And I do all I can to understand him and make sense of him and show the truth about him in my book, which has just been published, Churchill's Headmaster, The Sadist Who Nearly Saved the British Empire. So if you'd like to know more, then please do buy the book and so on. Okay, now I hope this has been of interest. And I hope that I'm sorry. I hope this has been you've enjoyed this. If you have any questions, please get in touch in the comments or get in touch with me on Twitter or email me or whatever. If you're a really lovely person, then you might consider helping. As you know, I'm an independent scholar, helping to fund me. I've had some lovely people now who've been helping to fund me on Patreon and on Subscribestar, and have been kind enough to drop me a few shillings on a PayPal. And so on. So if you're that lovely, if you're that kind, if you're that much of a non-Churchill and that much of a perhaps of a generous Herbert Snake Kinnersley, then please do consider doing that. But please do subscribe. It really, really helps me if you subscribe. While I'm here, I'd like to thank a lot of you who've got in touch with me. You've come up with some very interesting ideas. I'd like to note that I met some of you recently, some of my jolly heretics, and I was very pleased to do so. And I'd like to call out, I won't mention your names, because I suppose that's a bit complicated, but thank you very much. It was great to meet you. And so on. And I hope you have enjoyed this. And, well, goodbye. And perhaps we can just end by saying, as Churchill put it, if you're going through hell, keep going. That was one good thing he had to say. And it may be the case that we, who are in favour of the truth and of scientific heresy, are going through hell. But let's keep going. Let's keep going. And hopefully things will get better. But things, I think, will get better by keeping to certain traditions. And that's what Snake Kinnersley did. OK, well, I hope this has been of interest. And as I say, you do get in touch with all that. And goodbye!